All right, guys. So the way this works is we're going to do our search and seizure show, okay? And blue2gold.com/show is the place to go if you have questions for us. If you want to submit questions to us, if you say, hey, you know, I had this interesting case, you know, I think other law enforcement officers would benefit from it, please submit the questions to us, blue2gold.com/show. Go to our website, sign up for our free webinars. For those of you guys who weren't here with us for the free webinar, we just had a great one on, I think, you know, I'm biased, but we had a great one on Terry Stops, Terry Frisks. A lot of good information, and you cannot beat the price of a free webinar. We send you a certificate. It is a win-win-win-win situation, and we have a lot of fun, right? We got officers from across the nation throwing in their two cents, talking about situations they've been involved in. So please sign up for our free webinars. And if you guys have questions, if you have hypotheticals that you think would benefit other officers, blue2gold.com/show. So we have questions, right? We've got questions on deck if nobody in person or online has questions. And so what we want to do is we want to give preference to our people who are here, right? Who are online and with us. So if you guys have a question, right? You know, throw your hand up or let us know in the chat and we will turn your mic on if you are able to do so and have you ask us in person. A little bit about myself, guys. My name is John Ween. I'm an attorney and senior legal instructor with Blue to Gold Law Enforcement Training. I've been doing this a little over 2 years now. I have the honor and the privilege of traveling across the country and training law enforcement officers on search and seizure law. And it truly is an honor and a privilege for me. I love what I do. And really, compared to everything else, you know, my time, you know, in law enforcement, my time as an attorney, I really feel like this is, you know, making the biggest difference, the biggest positive difference that I can. And so it really is an honor for me. So thank you guys all for being here. Thank you for watching these webinars and sitting in on our search and seizure show. Joined with me here is my good friend, Chris. Chris, a lot of experience. Chris, tell us about yourself.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Chris McFarland, attorney and legal instructor with Blue to Gold. I've been doing this for quite a while now as far as teaching and training. It is my life. It is my passion. Current lieutenant at a sheriff's office in South Carolina. So I'm always doing in-service training, teaching something. Also teach in academia. We've got a little bit of a background in that, but training and teaching officers is my passion. And like John said, it's an honor and a privilege to get to travel the country and teach and be here with you tonight. So we're excited to get to your questions.
All right. Awesome. So let's get it going. Now, Clayton, are you still here, man? Clayton raised his hand and has been patiently waiting. And I think he left me. Ah, Clayton, break my heart.
Looks like Emmanuel maybe is the first one to the top that he has all a right. Question. Just going by what the chat says.
Let's do it. Let's get it started then.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, what's up? I'm Emmanuel, just Manny. We're for Harford County Sheriffs in Maryland. I have an interesting question. I kind of know the answer, but I just wanted to ask.
Awesome. Yeah, man. I mean, you know, obviously, like we said, in situations where even if you worked through it already and you're like, yeah, I know what I did and I know why I did it, it helps other law enforcement officers to walk through it. So by all means, whenever you're ready, hit us.
So yesterday I responded to like a weird domestic assault, whatever. They're not boyfriend, girlfriend, but they've been together for 2 years. So let's just call it that. Well, the boyfriend is homeless. And the girlfriend lives at her residence with her grandmother. She let the boyfriend use the car for like, and that's where he sleeps at. He uses the car to go to work, all his stuff's in the car and everything like that. Well, somebody's trying to call me at work. Sorry. I'm at work. I'm sorry. But, whatever, long story short, we figured out the domestic part, and then she's like, hey, I want my car back. Can I go get my car back? And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, yeah, sure. It's your property. It's your car. It's registered to you. His name's on the card and everything like that. So the question popped in my head to my coworker. I was like, hey, is this technically his domicile since he's living in the car? And my coworker's like, nah, it's her property. It's his car, property. But I'm like, yo, but all his stuff's there and he's homeless. He's clearly homeless. He's got his food there, all his clothes and everything like that. We ended up taking the car back from him and we didn't really tell him to kick rocks. We took his stuff to a storage unit and stuff. But my question is, was in that case, been living in the car for a year, girlfriend lets him sleep in the car. He does work on the car to maintain the car, use the car for work. Would that can be considered like a temporary domicile, or what do you guys think?
Well, Emmanuel, just my question, how long has he been living in the car, just for my own edification?
A year.
Okay. All right.
At a local library here.
What do you think, Chris? That's fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be an articulation, but I think generally speaking, unless there's something that, you know, is unknown here where you're at, I don't think that you're going to be able to say that, yeah, that's my home, that's my domicile. Yeah, I think there's going to be an issue with making that argument.
Yep. Yeah, it's her property.
Yeah.
And they're not married. You know, if you want to get into some kind of like a common law marriage argument in under state specific law, well, that's beyond the scope of.
That's kind of where I thought the question was going. This is almost like a civil law question. I was getting excited.
Right. Like, so that's
going to be those connection. Very often.
Yeah. Chris is going to be doing divorce law, family estate and estate planning, you know, just in case any cops need divorce law, you know, divorce. Yeah,
I'm going to have to be getting paid more money to do that again.
All right. So yeah, man, you're good, man. You're good. It's not his property. They might have some kind of a civil issue. I doubt it. Because you know, whatever kind of agreement they had, it's not a house, it's a car, it's her personal physical property. Despite the fact that he has, you know, worked on it and whatever, she's given him fair compensation for that. So yeah, it's her property. Take it back and give it to him.
The only thing I was like that hit my head, I was concerned about. I remember Anthony was speaking about it before when it comes to like homeless people and stuff. Is like we are now taking away like where he like shelters for the night, you know, and now he's kind of like left in the streets. Yeah. So I started thinking about it, like, damn, like. You know, I mean, we gave the car back to him. He figured it out. He left and went, did his own life, you know, whatever he had to do. But
so Manny,
that was the only thing I was thinking of.
Yeah. If you kick him out of her car, don't then arrest him for urban camping. Right. I mean, don't like hook him up for violating city code ordinances. Cause you took his house. Fair?
No. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. That's a silly question, but I figured I'd ask.
No, my pleasure, man. That was a great question. That's a great question. Fun stuff. All right. So.
Looks like maybe Devin is next.
No, Clayton is still here. He just rose to the top. Clayton, do you have a question for us?
He's got his hand raised.
I know. I'm so excited. I want to. He's been champing at the bit that for hour. All right, Clayton. Going once. Going twice. I'm gonna put your hand down.
Maybe he's at work too. He's on a call.
Probably is. He's out there saving lives.
That's right.
All right. Chris, who was next?
Looks like Devin was next.
Devin
for the win, no pun intended.
That's right. And he did win.
Hello, can you hear me?
We got you, Devin.
Got you.
Yes, sir. So I just had this question. I was talking to, you know, other officers about reasonable suspicion and Terry frisking somebody. My point is, you know, following you guys, I understand that they have to be, you know, you have to have a good reason of them being armed and dangerous before frisking. Now, however, there's a lot of old school cops that believe that they have the right to frisk pretty much anyone, and their justification is something generic like, oh, you just gotta, you know, just they could just take, you could just say something like baggy clothes, and I don't know if he has a gun or not, so I'm gonna check. And I'm trying to argue with them like, no, that you gotta have like more than just some kind of generic reason. But now they're Some officers would ask, well, is there a case law that you know of that you could show me that says something like that, that they need something more than that? And, you know, and I'm like, I'll look into it. I couldn't find anything, you know, really good that I could just show them that it doesn't, you can't just, you know, make generic reasons for everybody. Because you know, it wouldn't fly like that. So I was just wondering if y'all know any case laws or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole list of cases on that, Devin, that we could get you sent over. We're also on our website, the aspect of our website that's got the research with some case laws on it. That's one of the specific categories. But yeah, there's a lot of cases there. I mean, and I would just champion, you know, outside of Terry v. Ohio, and there's a language that was included there. You could look at any number of those cases and go, you know, this is a specific fact that happened in this case where the court said you can't just do what you're saying. And I get the whole old school mentality. Not sure how long you've been working, but I can remember working with some old school guys, and we used to say old school leads to jail school. You know, and in a lot of ways that's true. So I'm glad you're aware of that and that, but just, you know, be careful. And yeah, we look on our website. We've got some cases listed there. If you need some help, contact me. I'll be happy to email you some stuff over. Not a problem.
Yes, sir. Do any come to mind, or like just anything like on the top of your mind when I ask that?
For me, not specifically to be able to like give you any facts and summarize it right off the top of my head. John might. But I know there are a bunch out there.
Yeah, there, I mean, there's a whole lot, right? So Terry v. Ohio is obviously the big one. And New York had an issue with stop and frisk. I don't know if you remember that. That was kind of a big deal for them. But yeah, I mean, Arizona versus Johnson is another United States Supreme Court case. And that talks about the factors that you specifically need to articulate to frisk somebody. You know, in that case, in South Tucson, actually, officer stopped a vehicle occupied by multiple subjects who self-identified and were identified by records check as being Crips gang members. And so they went up, they made contact with them. One of the subjects in the back seat was digging around inside the vehicle, making those furtive movements, right? Furtive movements, meaning an attempt to obscure or hide from discovery, a movement reasonably consistent with reaching for a weapon or attempting to hide contraband. She ordered him out of the vehicle. He was wearing loose baggy clothing, which she articulated in her experience, gang members would wear and people who carry concealed weapons would wear, because it was harder to detect weapons and harder to locate, you know, identify those bulges or the imprints left by the butt of the gun. And so she frisked him and found a firearm. And Ninth Circuit said, no go, right? United States Supreme Court said, yeah, all day, right? All day. And so if you want, you know, shoot me or Chris an email, and we can find you any number of cases, but you are 100% right on this idea that you can't just do it, right? You can't do it just because, right? You have to be able to point to, and this is Terry v. Ohio language, right? Specific, articulable facts, more than a mere hunch to believe the person is armed and dangerous. A lot of case law out of the Ninth Circuit. What circuit are you in?
I think it's fifth, Texas.
Texas is the fifth.
Texas. Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's a reason, right? There's a reason why your old school guys think this way, because Texas courts are like, do it, right? But yeah, we've got any number of cases on you. If you want Texas specific, if you want Fifth Circuit, by all means, shoot me an email, shoot Chris an email. We'll be able to get you out. But Terry v. Ohio, Arizona versus Johnson, State versus Cerna is a great case out of Arizona. I'm trying to think, Texas versus Brown.
Minnesota v. Dickerson.
Yep.
Michigan v. Long. So Devin, I put some cases there in the chat. It's talking about reasonable suspicion. Here's some other ones that are on point with frisk. So I would just encourage you to take a read over those, look at the factors that were discussed that justify the officer's actions in those cases. You know, if that gives you some justifications there, or some argument to make, great, you know, but reach out to us. We'll be happy to get you more if you need it.
Yep.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, Devin, if you get a chance, man, take our bulletproof report writing class, because we actually go through there or get our bulletproof report writing book. We go through and we've got checklists in there about things to articulate, right? So furtive movements, loose baggy clothing, pat checking, tap checking, grooming cues, target glancing, right? We've got checklists and we walk through all of those, both in our bulletproof report writing class and in the book. I highly recommend our bulletproof report writing class. You know, I kind of fancied myself a good report writer. But even taking that class, like even if you think you are a good report writer, it's incredibly valuable because it goes through and gives you an idea. These are all the factors that you can articulate. Did you see this? Did you see this? Did you see this? Did you see this? I saw this. I saw this. I saw this. I didn't see this. I saw that. And then put it all in your report. Right.
Right. So, just for example, baggy clothes mixed with gang colors and a high crime rate, that's still not enough to say that they're armed and dangerous. Correct. Just say you only have those three factors, baggy clothes, right. He's wearing red in a blood area.
Right. So the question is, right, Terry stop versus Terry frisk. They're two separate things.
Right.
So do I have reasonable suspicion to believe that is specific articulable facts to believe they are, were, or about to be engaged in some kind of general criminal activity?
I'm just talking about the frisk. So my example was a shoplifter. Say the call you got, this guy stole some muffins. It's just something so small. So you got the reasonable suspicion to stop him for the stealing of the muffins, but now he's wearing a red shirt. Is a gang area? He maybe have a red bandana hanging out of his left pocket or something, baggy clothes, and that's all you have. So they're saying that's definitely enough. You just say that he had baggy clothes and you got reasonable suspicion all day that he's armed and dangerous. And then I'm saying I don't think that's enough just because of his baggy clothes and he's stealing muffins is the crime.
So Devin, I'm going to encourage you and teach others about, you know, everything that we do from the court's language has a scope, and you want to stay within the scope of what the law is allowing you to do, and you have to be able to recognize when the legal dynamic of an encounter has changed. So if your initial contact with that individual is related to theft, then, you know, obviously with patting them down, frisking them, you know, you have to be able to justify any types of weapons on them. But I would be careful using things that are outside of the scope for, you know, saying that, hey, he has a certain type of color on.
Right. And that's what I thought. I appreciate y'all.
Yeah, not a problem, Devin. But at the same time, right, you're not saying just because he's got baggy clothes. You're saying, I mean, is he identified in your system as a gang member? Is he self-identifying as a gang member? Do you have criminal history of him, you know, armed and like with weapons, right? I mean, it's all a totality of the circumstances.
Correct. Right. And if you have those, that's fantastic articulation to be able to do what you need to do at that point.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, awesome. All right.
So my internet cut out just for a moment. So my chat went away. I can't see who maybe chimed in with need to ask a question now.
All right. Bill, you got a question for us? I don't even care if Bill turns his mic on. I just want to stare at his picture. Right.
He might be trying to figure out how to turn his mic off there.
Yeah, he might.
So while we're waiting on that, I'll just throw this out to everyone, and maybe John mentioned this one. My internet had a little issue there, but the report writing book, when I teach, I recommend all of our books. They're great, but specifically on point, that report writing book, those checklists in them, I've gotten a lot of feedback from officers that have looked at that, got that book, and those checklists are fantastic. So I highly encourage that book, if for no other reason than those checklists. It can definitely help you with justifying articulation.
Yep. Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more, Chris. I think that book, more than any other, I mean, the Advanced Search and Seizure book, right? That's... Yeah. State-specific advantage.
That's kind of the bedrock of what we do, yeah.
Right. By and far, I've gotten the most positive feedback on that. But second follow-up is that report writing book. I mean, so many times I've had officers come to me and say, when I go to my supervisor and I ask him a question, he literally pulls out your report writing book and he's got it all tabbed up. And he opens it to the section, slides it across the table to me and says, read that. If you still have a question, come back and talk to me. And I'm like... Boom, right? Like, man, I can't think of a better endorsement than that, right?
You're a supervisor. If you're an FTO and you want to help the new guys out, fantastic tool. One of the best tools you'll ever use to be able to help them out.
Yep. All right, Bill, if you can't go mic on, can you throw a question into the chat and we'll try to answer it? And then...
It's like Amanda's got a question.
Amanda's got a question. And then Manny said he's got another one. If we can get back to him, let me see. Amanda.
Can you hear me?
We got you.
How are you guys?
Good. How about you?
Not too bad. So I have a question regarding, I think it's unprovoked flight, but I'm not quite sure. So my full-time job is I work as a lottery agent for the state of Kansas, and we're kind of in a high crime area in Topeka where we're located, but we had two individuals come in with stolen lottery tickets. The lady passed the lottery ticket and she was claiming it. This burglary happened 2 days prior to her coming in with the ticket. And we had already caught the actual burglar because he came in also to claim his stolen lottery tickets. But when we called our local, we called Topeka Police Department to come and assist us with the arrest or talking with our suspects because we're plainclothes in our building. Well, the gentleman she was with when Topeka police arrived, he started out the door and I went out after him and he walked out pretty quickly. I asked him to come back inside. He said, why? I said, well, we just need to ask you a couple of questions. He looked in Topeka Police Department where they pulled up direction and took off. So we both, me and Topeka chased him. He eventually stopped and he was arrested. They found meth in his pocket. But would that be unprovoked flight based on the ticket was recently stolen in the burglary? He saw TPD pull up, and then when I asked him to come back in, he ran.
Yeah. Amanda, if I'm understanding the facts correctly, I think that is a case of unprovoked flight, given the totality analysis that I'm kind of doing in my head here with all the factors that you've given out. But I guess some questions I might have, first of all, is did he actually have the tickets and you can associate him with another individual, or could the argument be made that he was just an individual that happened to be there for something unrelated to why you were there and he just decided, hey, I'm going to leave now? I mean, we know why he left. We get that. But from an argument standpoint,
he walked in with the female that had the stolen ticket.
Okay. So he's part of the criminal investigation.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Especially when he started out the door when TPD came up.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think the totality, you know, you articulate the totality of factors that you've got there. And I think, yeah, that would be an unprovoked flight situation.
He was also, two of our plainclothes agents had walked in and he had seen them walk in and passed him. And he was watching us through our very small window, very closely. That's another factor that I had added in when I decided to ask him to come back inside.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, I don't even think you need to call it unprovoked flight. It's nervous evasive behavior, right? And that is a factor in identifying reasonable suspicion. It's also a factor in identifying probable cause. And so do you have reasonable suspicion? Is there a moderate chance that he's involved in this criminal enterprise with this young lady? 100%, right? And so I've got RS for him. And so I can, you know, detain him as a law enforcement officer. Again, when you're in your role as a lottery enforcement, I don't know what police, do you have police powers when you're in that role?
I do. It's a law enforcement role.
Okay.
Or certified.
Yeah.
So you've definitely got the ability to use a reasonable amount of force to detain him. And so, you know, you have the authority to give him a command at that point. And then when he ignores you and runs off, again, I don't know if that would qualify as your obstruction statute or a violation of, you know.
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
He ended up having several probation violation warrants, a distribution warrant for meth, and
as well as having meth on him.
He had meth on. He tried to get rid of it, but he failed.
Yeah.
He reached into his pocket and we finally got to him, but and picked up another charge while he's in jail. So he's got like $41,000 worth of bonds sitting there.
And whenever somebody asked me why, I would just look at them and say, you know why. And that's when they would run.
That's interesting. I have one more quick question.
All right, what else you got?
People in custody can give valid consent prior to Miranda, correct?
Chris?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, generally speaking, the answer is yes.
Yes. There are some state issues.
Correct.
But by and large, the fact that the person is in custody does not mean that doesn't
invalidate their consent or their ability to give it.
Was that U.S. versus Watson, Chris? Was that the one where the dude?
I believe that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. He's in handcuffs, under arrest, in the back of a car, and still able to give valid consent, right? Despite that incredibly coercive atmosphere, ultimately, based on the totality of the circumstances, including the officer telling him, you don't have to let us. The court said, yeah, that's voluntary consent.
But you don't have to read Miranda prior to asking for that consent.
So here's the thing. Miranda applies when you're talking about custodial interrogation, right? And we're talking about eliciting incriminating responses. So, Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, is giving consent eliciting a criminal response? Do I have to give you consent?
No.
Can you compel me to give consent? Consent is just merely a question. We can ask anybody for consent. They don't have to give it.
Ooh.
Okay.
Chris, how about this? What about this? Amanda, here, a little twist for you, right? So what if there is a question as to whether or not he owns the vehicle? Chris, are you following me here?
If he owns the vehicle, yes.
Yeah, yeah, because then I say, hey, can I search your car? And he says, yeah, you can search my car. And so now is that potentially incriminating, because whatever I find in the vehicle, he has now said that that's his. If before then I didn't know if it was his vehicle or not, and my purpose in asking that question was to elicit that response that, yeah, that ownership. What do you like? What do you think? You like
now
it?
Now we're getting into some hearsay issues.
Fair enough. Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
If ownership is not an issue, then his giving you consent is not going to be testimonial.
Okay.
Yep.
I just was racking my head on that today, and I thought so, but it wasn't for sure.
While we're here, fantastic.
Thank you.
All right. Now, Bill. Bill,
we got him back.
He said, I think I got my phone back. Hello. There he is. Go.
Okay. Hey, so I work for a community college in Kansas, and in Missouri, marijuana is legalized. So we get a lot of students from Missouri that come here on our campus. Question is, when it comes to smelling marijuana, burnt marijuana in a car, the standing order that we've had in the past is that you could search if you smelled burnt marijuana in a car, you could tell them to exit their vehicles, search and seize marijuana in a car. My question to you is, what if we search that car knowing that the neighboring state, which is only a few miles from us, has legalized the substance? People do smoke marijuana a lot of times in their own car, and that scent stays in the car. And then they travel after the fact. Marijuana is a pungent odor that stay on your clothes or in your hair or in the car for hours, if not days, if your car's contained and closed up. My question is this still a valid search? And what if you search and you don't find anything? What kind of liabilities are you in that moment?
So, Bill, I guess my first question for you would be, if I understood you correct, marijuana is still illegal to possess in Kansas.
Correct.
Okay. So I think that's as far as your analysis needs to go. the fact that I'm from a state where it is legalized, great, good for you. And I understand what you're saying about residual odor being in the car. But hey, don't drive your car to a state where marijuana is illegal.
Okay.
As far as any subsequent liability for searching the car and not finding anything, we're kind of getting into a civil situation there, but I mean, are you acting in a good faith basis? Is it reasonable for you to believe, and you have probable cause under the laws as it's written in Kansas at that time, to do what you're doing. So absent any malicious intent while you're searching or fabricated smell, if you will, I don't think there's going to be any associated liability there with it just because this person happens to be from a state where it's legal to do it in that state. Unless there's something specifically in your statutes that address dealing with individuals from another state. And, you know, I'm a traffic guy through and through when I'm working the road. I love running traffic. And so I'll give you this example from kind of the traffic law area. Window tint oftentimes is addressed by states in their statute that say, you know, while this tint may be illegal in X state, we're going to recognize that if they're traveling in from another state and it's legal in that state, then we're not going to penalize that individual or do anything. But as far as criminal statutes on things like that, I've not seen one or am I aware of one that says, hey, if they're coming from a state where marijuana is legal, then you have to honor that in this state. And I'll let John take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm good with it, man. I mean, it's illegal in your state, Bill. And so plain smell before the world lost its mind and all these states started legalizing marijuana. If you have the odor of marijuana inside a vehicle, burnt or otherwise, there is a fair probability that there are drugs or drug paraphernalia inside that vehicle. And so fair probability is probable cause, right? And the United States Supreme Court, in describing probable cause, has said you don't have to be correct. It doesn't demand a showing that you be correct or even that it's more likely true than false, just that it's probable. And so is it probable? Case law has firmly established that the odor of marijuana inside a vehicle is probable cause to search that vehicle warrantlessly under the Carroll Doctrine.
Okay. I just wondered if things were beginning to change because even in our own state, a lot of appellate judges are turning down throw down drugs or whatever in cars a lot. You know, you got to prove possession and all of that. So a lot of those cases are being kicked out. I wondered if the sniff test was going to continue to be valid since they are legalizing it everywhere, but it sounds like it is.
Yeah. And one thing I'll tell you there, Bill, on that, when you start getting judges that are, they're doing things like that, a lot of that is I want to be cool and hip and I want to try to base my rulings and my decisions on society, what's becoming society, socially acceptable in norms, not necessarily what the law is. It's unfortunate in my opinion, but I mean, it does happen. So.
Very good. Thank you very much for being patient.
You're welcome, sir.
Right. Anybody else got anything for us? I know Manny said he's got another question. Manny, do you want to ask your other question? If anybody else got anything? All right. Anybody else? Raise your hand. Let us know.
I'm back.
You're back.
This question is kind of quick. I'll get some background real quick. But the question is, does a warrant have to be an NCIC in order for an agency to serve it? And here's the background. One of our detectives, one of my friends was working a case, big multi-state theft scheme going on and whatever. He was able to track down, two of the suspects were arrested, able to track down one suspect. We're here in Maryland. They tracked the suspect down in Miami. He had the original warrant in his hand, signed by the judge. They stopped him. He said, yo, he's right here. Miami-Dade police stopped him. They detained him. They called and said, hey, is the warrant NCIC? And he goes, no, but I can fax it to you, the original warrant, because we just got it issued. And the Miami-Dade was like, not to put him on blast, but Miami-Dade was like, No. The warrant has to be an NCIC before we can even serve it. We can't do anything with the original. And I guess my question is, does it have to be an NCIC? We have the original copy right in our hands, signed by a judge, and we fax it over and stuff like that. To supplement that, here in Maryland, we have a system. Some of the Maryland officers here might know, but it's like our court portal system. We can look up people's names on there, and we'll be able to see warrants issued through them, bench warrants, arrest warrants, that sometimes not an NCIC. So sometimes, like, I'll, you know, get out with someone, find a warrant in that system. They think they're good. They're negative NCIC check. And, but I'm like, wait, nope. Call the originating agency. It's only Maryland specific. There's a warrant on the system, and then we're able to detain. Hey, yep, we got the warrant in hand. We're just going to fax it over. So I don't know, Maryland, we kind of do that, but like, this is like from Maryland to Florida. So they were like going back and forth on the phone. He's like, dude, I have to go to records now. Records got to put an NCIC just for you to lock him up 5 minutes later and take him to the jail. So what do you guys think?
So, Manny, as far as I'm aware, I don't think there's anything necessarily, unless, you know, it's state specific that states, you know, it has to be an NCIC. Maybe it's an agency policy. It sounds like to me maybe that agency got burned a few times, and to avoid any potential liability that's incurring from an arrest without a warrant. And I get that. But, you know, for me, and John could chime in here, it's always been, has it been signed by a valid judge? And is it in hand by someone? Does the originating agency have the actual warrant in hand, and can that be verified? Justin there said, I fax warrants, not an NCIC. I've had them emailed to me. I've had them faxed. Because I go back to fax because I'm old, not like John. It happens. So absent some type of state-specific statute or something, maybe an agency policy, I don't think that is a general rule in the country that they have to be an NCIC to be considered a valid warrant.
Yeah, I kind of figured in my head, I was like, this is definitely like an agency policy thing. Like, they want it, an NCIC, in order for it to be like, I don't know, give them like that warm and fuzzy, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
I can't fault them for that, because like Chris said, probably somebody got burned sometime, and so now they're CY and their A's.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. I appreciate you guys very much.
No problem.
Glad you were here.
All right. Where are we at, guys? Anybody else got anything for us? Because we're getting up on that hour. We'll call it if nobody else has got anything for us.
11 p.m. out here on the East Coast.
I know.
I love it.
All right, guys. Oh, okay.
Can we do one submitted question?
One submitted question. But how to pick, Rick? How to pick?
Rick pick? Rick pick. I like that. It's a good way to get out of it, Rick.
He said it isn't. He said as long as you have the original warrant, good to go. But it may be an agency policy.
Hey, Manny, mute your mic, my man.
I thought that was Rick. All right.
I've got one here, John. If you want me to throw it out for everybody's benefit.
Which one are you thinking?
Number three. Maybe it's a case that they haven't heard of.
Yeah, sure. Do that one. I wanted you to do number one so we could spend like 3 or 4 hours on that one. But yeah, let's do three.
So just went out for a minute. Now I'm back.
All right. So here we go. Officer from Michigan calling in says, I am an FTO with my department. I have a question about Kansas versus Glover. I have read the case law, but I'm still confused. Can you help us out? All right, Chris.
Yeah, so I mean, for individuals, and I'm going to post the link here in the chat in case you want to look it up yourself. But for individuals that aren't familiar, basically Kansas v. Glover, rather. Let me get it pulled up here. Essentially, we got a case where a Kansas deputy sheriff ran a license plate check on a pickup truck, discovering that the truck belonged to a respondent, Glover, that the owner's driver's license had been revoked. So deputy initiates a traffic stop, the long and short of it is, and determines that it was, in fact, Glover driving, and he was charged with driving as a habitual violator. I'm sure most people have something similar to that in their jurisdiction. And essentially, the argument was made that he did not have reasonable suspicion to essentially stop the individual. Went all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they essentially reversed the Kansas Supreme Court decision. And the Supreme Court said, when an officer lacks information negating an inference that the owner is driving the vehicle, an investigative traffic stop made after running a vehicle's license plate and learning that it is registered to the owner's driver's license and the registered owner's driver's license has been revoked, it is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment to conduct a stop under those situations. So I think sometimes this is, I think I know what's going on, so I do a stop, but I can't quite, I can't be 100% accurate. Yes, that's the individual that's driving just because it's registered, because we know people borrow individuals' vehicles all the time. But yes, absent some state-specific issue with that, the general consensus is, and the Supreme Court said, that was a reasonable stop under the Fourth Amendment.
So, Chris, I got two questions for you, man.
Let's do it.
I run a license plate, and it pops. The driver has a warrant. Can I stop the car?
Yes, if it's a reasonable belief that that individual is the one driving the vehicle.
Okay. All right. So you think the same rationale, suspended driver, it applies to a warrant as well. And arguably, it would apply even more because there is a greater governmental interest in preventing that type of crime. Agreed?
Agreed.
Beautiful. All right. So what happens if I run the license plate and it comes back female RO, female registered owner, and she's got warrants, and yep. I walk up there and I look in the vehicle and it is a dude driving the car. What do I do? Can I get that license? Can I get that registration? Can I get that insurance?
No, then you're going to have a problem at that point.
Okay. So what do I do?
Yep. Well, I think you're going to have to explain what was going on, the reason for your stop, that, you're gonna have to articulate. I didn't see this individual. I wasn't able to discern that this was a female and it was an actual male. Okay. And then break that contact and that contact at that point, because to go any further, what are your grounds?
Gotcha.
So I turn the question back around.
My suspicion's been dispelled.
Correct.
Right. So I go up, I make contact, and reasonably, I think a court would agree. You can explain, hey, somebody associated with this vehicle has a warrant. That's why I made the stop. You're not that person.
And perhaps the driver is closely matching the identity of the individual who may have the warrant. Yeah. But once that's dispelled, yeah, contact us off. Now, I really like Brian's answer here, and I kind of want to do that the next time I conduct a traffic stop and that happens. I'm just contacting you about your car's extended warranty. It's fantastic there. Love it.
So if you get up there and you confirm that your suspicions are dispelled, the person, the RO is not the person, or the person driving is not the registered owner.
Yep.
I don't get their license. I don't get nothing. I just say, hey, somebody associated with this vehicle has a warrant for their arrest.
It's obviously that you. Person is not you.
Drive safely.
Have a nice night. Absolutely.
There you go. Awesome. All right, guys.
Any questions from anyone about that case? Any kind of similar situation?
Correct, Brian. Do not ask for that DL. And I'll tell you, man, there is some stuff out of Colorado, right? That's like hardcore stuff out of Colorado. Like, you should not even walk up to that vehicle. I don't think that that's realistic. I don't want to take it to that degree. Oregon absolutely would take it to that degree. Oregon says, if you walk up and your suspicions are dispelled, you should say nothing to that driver. You should turn around, walk back, get in your car and drive away. 100% Oregon would say that. Because what's the concern, right? If I walk up and I'm like, oh, hey, just so you know, the person who owns this vehicle has a warrant. It's not you. Have you been drinking? Right now, potentially do we have an issue? Right. I think in most states, no, because you're being reasonable. But is there an argument to be made that you are continuing that stop without RS? Argument to be made. So just be careful. Absolutely do not get the DL. I think it's realistic. I think it's reasonable to go up and explain the reason for the stop and wish them a nice day and say, be very careful when you pull out so you don't get hit. I don't think you need to turn around and run back to your vehicle and drive off Super Trooper style. But just be aware, right?
I mean, unless you're trying to get a complaint filed on you for, messing with people. Other than that.
100%, right? There you go. Dennis has got it. All right. Now, Christian's got a question. Christian, coming in at the buzzer, man. Coming in at the buzzer.
Last one.
Chris has got to go to bed, man. You're partying. You're partying too hard out there on the East Coast.
That's right.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
All right. I'm the same person who answered the last question the last session we had. So I got a, it's just more of a, an opinion that I want of you that I want. So last year I stopped somebody for expired registration. I conducted a check of their license plate and registration showed expired. So when I made contact with the guy, I immediately could smell the odor of marijuana coming from inside the vehicle. But sure enough, whenever I looked at his registration registration sticker, it was current. So it wasn't expired, but I received a expired return. So basically, in short, the DA's office ended up throwing it out, saying that I didn't have sufficient reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle. So I just kind of want your guys' opinion on that one. And they didn't specify again why they determined I didn't have sufficient reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle. They just, again, it just kind of ended there, and they dismissed the case. So I ended up charging them with UCW and then all, obviously possession of marijuana here in Texas. I didn't have enough for Mandale. He had around 5 pounds of marijuana inside the car, but just kind of wanted your guys' opinion. Any reason you guys think the DA's office would, you know, make that determination?
I've got a lot of opinions why I think DAs might do the things they do, and especially as a former DA. But look, I think the issue here is, you know, you were acting under good faith. You were relying on a system that you rely on every day to provide you solid information. You acted on that information, which I think is very reasonable. And you made contact. And then just like we do for many times, we make a traffic stop for one thing and we walk up to the car and boom, I went from, you know, a traffic matter. And now I'm in the middle of a criminal investigation. So I think in other jurisdictions, that probably would not have been a problem. But, you know, having lived and having worked in Texas, down in Harris County specifically, you know, I know sometimes in larger jurisdictions like that, DAs can do some funny things. Obviously, I don't know exactly why, but I think the takeaway from that is, you know, I've not identified anything based on what you told me that you were acting improperly or that there was anything improper about what you did. You know, and I don't know how many years you've been working, how many years you've been in the game, but you know, this is where I tell younger officers, you know, do what you can do and what the system allows you to do. And then you kind of have to release the ball and hope that the other participants in the criminal justice system are going to thoroughly do their job. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. And that's just the nature of our job, nature of our business.
Yeah. And then who's hosting the class tomorrow in Forest Hill? Because I'll be there.
Which class is that?
The one in Forest Hill tomorrow, Forest Hill, Texas.
I would have to look that up. Richard may be able to get that information faster.
Okay. All right. I thought it was one of you guys. So
it is not me, unfortunately. Craig Meyer.
All right. I appreciate
Mr. Meyer. Great class. You'll love it.
All right. Well, Chris.
I think that's about a wrap.
Yeah.
Great. It's been a great show.
Well, it was absolutely my pleasure, man. Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
Not a problem. Anytime. All right. Still love doing it.
Okay. Well, everybody, be safe out there. If you guys have any questions for us, bluetogold.com/show, bluetogold.com/show. Make sure you sign up for our free webinars. If you guys are interested in hosting, training at bluetogold.com, we would love to come out. Chris and I apparently are going to co-teach in New Orleans very soon. I'm looking forward to that.
I think Aaron's got to line that up.
He's got to make that happen.
Email tomorrow.
That's right. That's right. So everybody else, Chris, final thoughts?
I'm good. Wish everybody good night. Stay safe out there, guys. Check us out. We got a lot of great training. Love to be a part of your agency and help you guys out.
Beautiful. All right, guys. Until next time, be safe out there and make good case law.